Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The Israeli leadership announced this morning that it wouldn't hesitate to bomb Syria. Again. There are, according to Israel's vice premier, Ehud Olmert, no limitations regarding targets as long as they are connected to the terrorist acts. The latest escalation in Mideast violence saw Israel bombing an empty campsite in Syria in retaliation for 19 killed and many others wounded in a weekend suicide bomb attack in Haifa. The Bush White House has offered no criticism. Instead, the president is supporting Israel's right to defend itself, saying in so many words that when you're dealing with terrorists, you got to do what you got to do. Connection listeners, the Arab-Israeli conflict has now moved outside the borders that mark Israel and Palestinian land. Israel does so saying, that's how you fight a war on terror. Does this mean that all the political issues of land and legitimacy and sovereignty are off the table? And what are the prospects for peace if international preemption becomes an accepted rule of engagement in this conflict? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start today by going to the West Bank. BBC correspondent Barbara Plett is standing by on the line in Ramallah. Hello, Barbara.
Hello.
I understand that Prime Minister Sharon said today Israel will hit its enemies any place, any way. We know what Olmert said earlier in the day. Tell me how this is changing the conflict from the perspective where you're watching it on the West Bank.
Well, certainly statements like that do fill the Palestinians with alarm and also the actual attack in Syria, because if Israel is allowed to violate international law with impunity, if it's done in the name of terrorism, then that's very worrying to the Palestinians, because they're really their main support for their claims of national self-determination in a state is international law. You know, UN resolutions that talk about Israeli withdrawals and so on. On the other hand, I think I would have to say that the Palestinian leadership, at any rate, might welcome a bit of a distraction from Yasser Arafat right now, because, of course, the Israelis have been threatening to remove Mr. Arafat. Now they seem to be engaged elsewhere, at least for the moment, and that would be a bit of a relief anyway for Mr. Arafat.
But when we read reports of Arafat cobbling together an emergency cabinet and putting his new prime minister, Ahmed Correa, in for a short period of time, that smacks of a form of desperation on the Palestinian part. Is it seen that way by anyone else there?
Oh, yes, it's absolutely a desperate move. The reason we have this emergency cabinet is a direct result of the suicide bombing in Haifa on Saturday, after which the Israelis renewed their threats to remove Mr. Arafat. There had been negotiations, long drawn-out negotiations, going on for a while, for about 4 weeks, I think, about the composition of a new government. And Mr. Arafat had been under pressure from the United States and from other international players to get on with it and to fill the leadership vacuum, because at a time like this, you don't really want to have nobody at home. So he didn't seem to be feeling that threatened during that period, and I think that the Haifa bombing focused his thoughts. He's put together something that he's saying, well, look, I am projecting leadership. There is somebody here. And maybe some form of diplomatic process can resume, although I don't think anybody believes it will go anywhere, really, at this point.
Barbara, just a week ago, we were talking about Israel's threat to remove Yasser Arafat, even the suggestion from members of the cabinet that Yasser Arafat should be assassinated. Is that still something that is being talked about in Ramallah?
Oh, yes. It's very much the consciousness here. I mean, people here feel that the situation is very fragile, because that decision is a cabinet decision made in principle, which means that it could be acted on at any time, really. The only thing that would perhaps stop it is the United States. And we do know that the United States doesn't want Arafat removed right now, because it doesn't want a sort of regional disruption at a time when it's sort of dealing with Iraq. But at the same time, it hasn't condemned Israel's decision in any moral or legal terms, which leads one to think that it is just a matter of timing. The two countries do seem to be thinking along the lines, or at least similar lines. And that has the Palestinians very worried. Yes, they feel that the situation is extremely fragile.
We'll be talking through this hour, Barbara, about why Israel has chosen to widen the conflict. From your perspective there, what are the people there saying about why Israel chose Syria as a target?
Well, I don't think that Syria is a strange target if you look at the history of the two countries. I mean, there have been enemies for a long time. The Israelis have often accused Syria of backing Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance movement along the border, northern border with Israel. They have also increasingly, during the Intifada, focused on the Palestinian opposition groups, some of which are based in Syria.
I think, Barbara, we've lost our connection to you. That was Barbara Plett, BBC correspondent based in the West Bank, talking to us from Ramallah. Let's go next to Matthew Levitt. Matthew's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's a former FBI counterterrorism analyst. He's joining us from the Christian Science Monitor studios in Washington. Matthew, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me what in your mind has changed when the Israeli cabinet makes a decision to take its fight with the Palestinians outside the borders where that fight has been taking place for the past 3 years.
I think largely from the Palestinian perspective, from the Israeli perspective, you know, this has been a conflict that has not just been going on within Israel's borders for some time. The problem is that the imbalance is that all the violence was happening within Israel's borders while all the support for that violence was happening in Syria and elsewhere. I think there are two key things that led Israel to seriously consider and now implement a plan to target specific training camps and other targeted sites in Syria. First is that over the past 3 years or so of the Intifada, there has been a very, very sharp increase in training camps in Syria operating primarily under the PFLPGC, Ahmed Jabril's group, training Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Al-Aqsa terrorists and others. Alongside that, there's been a sharp increase in the funding that Islamic Jihad leaders resident in Damascus have been sending into operatives in the West Bank. When the Israelis went into the West Bank in April 2002, they discovered that the extent of that funding and the direct communication between terrorists in the West Bank who were conducting suicide bombings targeting civilians and leadership in Damascus was far more extensive than they had thought. And then in May, there were two British citizens who conducted a suicide attack in Tel Aviv. And as the investigation into that progressed very quickly, it was determined that these two individuals were sent on their mission and were trained by Hamas leaders in Damascus, Ahmed al-Alami in particular. These events, I believe, most significantly focused the Israelis on the fact that Syria was being allowed to organize, fund, train, facilitate terrorist attacks in Israel, attacks that were undermining the peace process with impunity.
All right, Matthew, hang on a second. I'd like to bring in Muin Rabbani. He's a senior Middle East analyst for the International Crisis Group. He's joining us from the BBC studios in Amman, Jordan. Muin, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
The way that Matthew is describing this is that the growth of support, the increase in training and the increase in funding from abroad made Israel's move into Syria almost inevitable. Do you see it that way?
Well, obviously, there is Syrian support for Palestinian groups engaged in the current uprising, especially Palestinian opposition groups such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad. I don't think the training component is really that significant. My suspicion is that most training of members of these organizations concerns members that remain in Syria or Lebanon just because the border controls are so tight. And I think the idea that somehow suicide bombers need to go to Damascus for training to carry out their attacks strikes me as somewhat absurd. So, you know, the idea that somehow Syria is a prime actor in this uprising, and that somehow ceasing the support that comes from or through Syria to the Palestinian organizations is in any way going to lead to an end of the uprising, I think is vastly overstated, to say the least. I mean, if Syria were to disappear tomorrow, we would still have the uprising on our hands. Islamic Jihad does have a presence and an active presence in Syria and Lebanon, but for the most part, its activities within the occupied territories in Israel are locally generated.
But are you saying then, Muin, that the move is a significant shift in Israel's policy in trying to come to terms with Palestinian violence?
I think it's really too early to draw that kind of sweeping conclusion. I mean, is this just a, you know, one-off attack to help divert Israeli public opinion from Israel's failure to move against Arafat, as had been widely expected and even demanded by a broad segment of Israeli public opinion after the Haifa attack? Or, you know, is this the beginning of a larger campaign in which Israel appears to have very successfully framed its conflict with the Palestinians within the framework, actually is part and parcel of the, you know, U.S. Global war against terrorism? And so is this the beginning not only of Israeli attacks against Palestinian groups that exist in Syria, but also maybe as part of a broader campaign to seek to foment regime change in Damascus? I think the jury's still out on that. And I think much of it depends on what happens in the coming days and weeks, whether this has been just a one-off Israeli attack, mm-hmm. whether there is a significant Syrian or Palestinian or Lebanese response furthering the escalation. I think these things remain to be seen.
Matthew, let me hear you on the idea that it was more a message than an attack that was necessitated. You and I both know how good the Israeli pilots and Air Force are, and that if they want to hit a building in Gaza, they'll hit it. If they want to hit a training camp that is active in the hills of northern Syria, they're going to hit it. They struck a camp with nobody there. I mean, it was in many ways like using a missile as rhetoric in trying to get the attention of the people in Damascus. In a way, that seems to indicate that they just wanted to make the point that they could, not that they had to. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think it was just more a sign of a responsible first attack. You know, there are gradations in these types of activities, and you don't want to take the most severe action that you possibly can just because you can.
Right.
The fact that these camps have been activated in the past 3 years is a fact that's agreed upon by American, Israeli, and other intelligence services. And I think that the Israelis were frustrated with the fact that everybody knew that and nothing was being done about it. This is to the extent, for example, that when the Israelis interrogated Nasser Weiss, one of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade's operatives and other Islamic Jihad operatives about a year ago, they learned that Al-Aqsa, Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and others have been undergoing training in PFLPGC camps like this one. I don't know if it was this particular one right around Damascus. What's more disturbing, though, is that they found that these operatives were coming into Syria via Jordan, where they were met at the border by Syrian officials who escorted them to these camps and stood by on the sidelines to make sure they were properly treated. I think that the idea that if you took Syria out of the picture, you'd have no diminishing of the violence in the territories is simply false. And we know, for example, that Akram Azuri, one of the Islamic Jihad operatives in Damascus, personally recruited operatives like Mohammed Barawish back into operational service after he was released from a Palestinian jail in 2001, and then transferred $7,000 to him to reorganize the Islamic Jihad network in Hebron. And then over the process of the course of the next few months, sent him upwards of $100,000 for specific suicide attacks. If you take Syria out of the equation, I think it would do a lot of good to calm the situation and enable the parties to get back to the peace process.
Let me stop you there,
Matthew. I think this is a far cry from regime change.
It raises a lot of questions about what Syria's response will be. It raises questions about whether or not the Arab-Israeli conflict has now become more part of a war on terror than the fight within the borders that we've watched, as I said, for the past 3 years. Connection listeners, our number's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about the change in the Middle East fighting between Israel and the Palestinians when it shifted, as it did on the weekend, to an Israeli airstrike against Syria. What changed in a larger sense there? With me on the program, Matthew Levitt, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's a specialist in terrorism and U.S. policy. Muin Rabbani is a senior Middle East analyst for the International Crisis Group based in Amman, Jordan. And Muin, let me start with you if I can, because when President Bush was asked about this, he said, and I'm quoting him here, I made it very clear to the Prime Minister, like I have consistently done, that Israel has got a right to defend herself, that Israel must not feel constrained in terms of defending the homeland. And I was struck by his use of the word homeland and wondered whether or not, in your view, that tells us anything about America's shifting attitudes or policy towards this particular conflict.
Well, I think if you look at the Arab world, certainly as far as public opinion is concerned, the vast majority of people here have come to the conclusion that the idea of any U.S. criticism of Israel is simply out of the question. I mean, here you had Israel attacking a site just outside of the Syrian capital, Damascus, mm-hmm. in clear violation of the 1974 ceasefire agreement, which has maintained the quietest border in the Middle East now for three decades. And the U.S. response is basically to say that this is legitimate self-defense. There was some criticism of Syria, as I recall. And in so many words, to basically say Israel is doing exactly what we'd be doing under the same circumstances.
But in now, fairness, again, though, Mouin, the United States was quite critical of Israel just last week for its construction, continued construction of the wall. It's not like they'll never speak out, is it?
Well, I'm not saying that they'll never speak out or raise certain questions, but the idea of the U.S. actually making forceful statements that most people in this region believe will be understood by Israel as clear and explicit criticism, making it very clear to Israel that they expect a fundamental transformation of its conduct vis-a-vis the Palestinians, I think most people have completely lost hope that they feel that this current administration, U.S. Middle East policy under the Bush administration, is basically totally beholden to Israel's strategic views of how this conflict should be conducted and how this region should be transformed.
Matthew Levitt, when you hear the president talking about the Israeli homeland in context of that attack, what are you hearing in terms of the way that Bush chooses to characterize the U.S. relationship with the region?
I think President Bush understands post 9/11 and post this massive attack on the United States, on our soil, on our citizens, what it must be like to face that kind of situation on a daily basis. I think no one has done more to push and to nudge the parties, Israelis and Palestinians alike, towards peace. But I think that Washington understands that nothing undermines the prospect, the legitimate and important prospect of the establishment of a Palestinian state, more than Palestinian terrorism. I think the president looks and sees at Syria's continued chemical and biological weapons programs. It looks and it sees Syria's less than constructive role in Iraq, where volunteers or jihadis, I call them jihadis only because the Syrian travel documents on which many of them have entered Iraq are stamped jihadi, in case you are unclear on the purpose, have created problems for us in Iraq. I think the president sees himself as someone who has tried, especially in his June 24th speech and since then, to prod the parties towards peace, and sees Syria as a party that is doing everything it can to thwart that possibility.
Matthew, you're talking about a chemical and a biological weapons program in Syria. You're talking about a big base of support there for attacks on Israel. Are you talking about the idea that it wouldn't be a bad idea for Israel or the United States to actually engage Syria in conflict here rather than just bomb a training camp?
Absolutely not. There's no reason for that. No one is looking for regime change in Syria. People are looking for behavior modification in Syria. I think that's why Israel chose the type of target it chose. And I think that's why the United States has been trying so hard to engage Syria, despite its unfortunate behavior in diplomatic means. We've sent the Secretary of State to Damascus now a second time. For the second time in a row, President of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, has made promises that he's not kept. The first time he promised the United States that an illicit oil pipeline from Iraq to Syria would cease pumping oil, which Syria was pumping in violation of United Nations Security Council resolutions, even as it sat on the United Nations Security Council. Shortly, for about a week and a half, that pipeline was shut, and then it continued to flow again. Now the secretary went back and asked that the headquarters of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other groups in Syria be shut down, specifically demanding that they not just be moved elsewhere. And we now know that not only were they moved elsewhere temporarily, were they making phone calls from other places, apartments instead of offices, but that those offices are now open again. We need everybody, parties in the region. We need Arab states. We need everybody to play a productive role if there's to be a peace process here.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Arlington, Massachusetts. Matt's calling in. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to weigh in. It seems, though, that my topic was addressed, but Dick, I have to disagree with you when you say that Israel has moved the conflict outside of its borders now. This conflict has always been outside of its borders. There really aren't any training camps, any terrorist training camps inside of Israel. These trainings, the funding is happening from outside of its borders.
The money part I get, Matt, but I also hear what Muin's saying when he makes the point that you probably don't need to take somebody outside Gaza to teach them how to strap on a belt load of explosives.
True, but that's where it's happening. It's happening outside of Gaza. It's happening outside of...
I guess the point that I'm making is that it's happening there as well, right?
Correct, it is. It's happening everywhere. And Israel, you know, needs to address this and needs to put a hurt on some of these places that are sending in these people on a daily basis and training them on a daily basis. Countries are funding and teaching terrorism. Governments are teaching terrorism.
Okay, but that comes from Pakistan. It comes from Iran.
So
do we? Is it time to put a hurt on all these countries?
If you harbor terrorism, you are. If you harbor terrorists, you are a terrorism. Is that not right? Maybe it is. Maybe it's time that governments realize. Look, I'm not a Middle East expert. I don't claim to be. I don't feel that Israel is a country that wants constant war. Israel is a country that wants peace. They are a democratic society like we are. They want to live in peace. And if these other nations aren't going to seriously take a look at their population and demand that they stop this, then maybe it is time for Israel to step up their air force and to take out these training camps.
Muin Rabbani, tell me whether or not, in your view, there are people in Iran on this day wondering whether or not there'll be an Israeli airstrike against the nuclear facility that's under construction there. There's precedent for that. Are there people looking at what happened in Syria and going, holy smokes, this could get a whole lot bigger, a whole lot faster?
Well, I think certainly the Iranians have publicly expressed concerns and worries about a possible Israeli airstrike against Iran to take out the nuclear facilities there. And I don't really think that that this latest Israeli attack on Syria is going to fundamentally change those perceptions, because I think an attack on Iranian nuclear facilities would be something of a completely different order. And I would tend to doubt that this single strike would be seen by the Iranians as bringing the possibility of such an attack that much closer. I would tend to see these as two separate issues.
But the risk that the conflict will widen, though. I mean, you do have Bashar al-Assad sitting there going, how am I supposed to demonstrate my own standing as a leader in Syria? What do I do now?
Well, that's I think the real issue, and ultimately it comes down to the same question: is this a military conflict with a military solution, as Ariel Sharon seems to have consistently advocated and pursued since assuming office in early 2001, or is this a fundamentally political conflict that requires a political solution, in which much you know, as great as it would be to have negotiations without any violence, whether Palestinians against Israelis or Israelis against Palestinians, going on at the same time, ultimately I think this conflict will need to be resolved in the same way as all other conflicts throughout history have been resolved, whereby the appointed leaders of the two parties negotiate precisely because they're at war, mm-hmm. and seek to find a negotiated settlement of their political differences. But I think, once again, the very big risk here is that, you know, this single attack due to an unexpected reaction by Syria, for example, because it's unable to get a clear condemnation of Israel at the UN Security Council and will therefore feel it has to, you know, do something else to get its own back from Israel, or Israel following up on this attack with further attacks, could put us down the slippery slope to escalation.
Matthew Levitt, that's a real risk, isn't it, one reaction causes another and another and another?
You know, in this case, I really don't think it is. I think that Israel, the target that Israel chose is significant. I think you're right. It was intended to send a message more than prevent the next act of terrorism. But I think the message is clear. The next time they'll hit a terrorist training camp that is occupied, and the time after that they'll hit a Syrian military installation or something like that.
Do you think there was a message for the Iranians in this
also?
As well?
Pardon?
Do you think there was a message for the Iranians in this, for the Lebanese?
I don't. I agree with Muin that these are separate issues. And I also agree with him that we need to focus on the difference between, you know, resolving a conflict politically and trying to resolve it militarily. Of course, this conflict will not simply be resolved militarily, but it's all the more reason why we have to deal with those elements that are trying to militarize this conflict and are trying to undermine prospects for political dialogue. Political dialogue simply will not flourish under the situation of terror and under the situation of state sponsorship of terror. Groups like Islamic Jihad and Hamas, states like Syria and Iran, have demonstrated time and again that when the peace process is doing well, they will try and escalate attacks to try and undermine it. And when the peace process is not doing so well, they'll try and keep up those attacks to make sure that it doesn't resume. And it's irresponsible to allow that to continue.
1-800-423-8255 to Boston now. And Dave's joining us. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how are you today?
Hi. Thanks.
I just wanted to ask your guests, the two gentlemen, very insightful views on this topic. You have a European-trained dentist whose father passed away.
I think he's an ophthalmologist.
I'm sorry. Reluctantly was recalled back to Syria to take over after his father, Hafez al-Assad, died. He's still surrounded by all of his father's people. And it seems he is a person who's known for having rather liberal, relatively liberal views on ways of resolving this conflict. He makes promises, of course, to Secretary of State Powell, promises he was unable to keep because those people around him won't let him. He's walking on eggshells there.
So what's your question,
Dave? He's in a predicament. Wouldn't it be better for the Israelis to try and find a way to somehow aid in the elimination of the people around him so that he can actually begin to be the leader of Syria, who is now leading that country?
Yeah,
and that's the question.
I'm not sure, Dave, whether or not the Israelis have the sway in Damascus to do that, but the United States might well by offering more support for Bashar al-Assad. Matthew Levitt, is that not the sort of political solution that you're referring to?
Absolutely. And indeed, it's the type of political solution that Washington has been attempting. This is not the type of thing you'll read about in the front pages of the New York Times. The idea here is not to give Bashar al-Assad unqualified support, but to try and do things that could support him and try and remove him from the very powerful individuals who are alongside his father who still run the show. That has not proven successful. Bashar al-Assad has not agreed to engage with us in an effort to move away from those individuals. And the very, very exciting prospects that many of us held out for Bashar al-Assad when he first came to office have simply not come to fruition. And I think that the administration still hopes to try and find a way to get Bashar al-Assad to prove himself to be a more productive partner.
Muin Rabbani,
part of it, of course, is indeed the people that surround him. Part of it is his own decision making.
What would it take, Muin Rabbani, to give him the medal to make the sorts of decisions that might allow him to stand up to the generals? I mean, I think it is reasonably well understood that Bashar al-Assad does have some more liberal leanings that he's been unable to exercise, because ever since he replaced his father as head of Syria, that country has been at or watching a conflict right across its borders. What would it take?
Well, I would certainly agree that all the indications show that the so-called old guard is still very much in control in Syria, although I would add that I think this has much more important ramifications for Syria's domestic policies than it does for its approach to the Arab-Israeli conflict. As far as Assad the Younger's approach towards Israel, I see very little daylight between his approach and that of his father, which is that he will accept nothing less than a full withdrawal of Israel to the pre-June 1967 ceasefire boundaries, and failing a clear Israeli agreement to do that, he, as the leader of a militarily weak state, will use whatever cards he can, whether it's Hezbollah in Lebanon or relationships with these Palestinian organizations to make life difficult for the Israelis. Now, in terms of what would allow him to seek greater control over Syrian policies and perhaps liberalize the system further, I think the indications are that the more Syria has been pressured, whether as a result of now the U.S. Presence in Iraq or increased tensions with Israel, actually tends to strengthen the hand of the old guard rather than weaken it.
What about that, Matthew, that when President Bush chooses to praise Israel for going after the terrorists rather than you know, wag the finger about not widening the conflict, that he radicalizes not only the militants in Syria, but provides the kind of support that the old guard needs to stay in control there?
I think that it's a misnomer to think that Bashar al-Assad today, in contrast with the high hopes we had for him when he first came to office, is all that much more progressive than the people that surround him. In fact, Bashar al-Assad has taken steps that his father never would have. Bashar al-Assad no longer only allows the transshipment of Iranian arms to Palestinian terrorists, resistance or opposition, whatever you want to call them, which his father did. He now has transferred Syrian arms directly to Hezbollah. He has a very, very close relationship with Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, a gentleman who his father used to his benefit, but kept at arm's length.
But briefly, though, isn't there a risk that he or his generals, though, will only be further radicalized by the airstrike this past weekend and the U.S. reluctance to criticize Israel for doing it?
Again, I point to the fact that the target that the Israelis chose gives him some face-saving opportunities here. There are ways to move out of this. There are ways to move out of his tensions with the United States in a way that saves face and enables him to assert a position of control. Part of that has to do, as Muin said, with his precarious situation at home. There was a recent cabinet reshuffle just the other week that happened actually while I was in Amman. And it also has to do with his situation, which is not as strong as he'd like it to be in Lebanon.
Connection listeners, are we talking about a widening of the war on terror here? Are we talking about a dramatic change in what we've come to understand as the Arab-Israeli conflict when the Israeli Air Force chooses to strike Syria? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program today, Muin Rabbani, Senior Middle East Analyst for the International Crisis Group. He's based in Amman, Jordan. Matthew Levitt is also with us from the Christian Science Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. He's a Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Quincy next, and Harold's on the line. Hi, Harold.
Good morning.
Thank you for calling.
Fine. I have a few things to say rather than to ask a question. The first Gulf War, Israel's hands were tied when Saddam threw the Scuds into Israel because of the massive coalition and support prevented them because they were assured that Israel would be protected. My fear at this war, when we attacked Iraq, was that Saddam, with his, quote, nuclear weapons of mass destruction or Scud missiles, etc., would throw them into Israel, and that would unleash a real Holocaust in the Middle East. It didn't happen because he didn't have those weapons, okay? Now, Israel is in such a state of panic and fear because of the suicide bombings. What can they do? They can't go into Palestine anymore. They're building a fence around it. It's a total concentration camp. Ariel Sharon has got his finger on the pile of nuclear weapons. I believe that the world should be afraid. That's the terror in the Middle East. Nuclear weapons, power of mass destruction, are in the hands of one of my luntsmen. I'm a Jew, and I'm afraid that the Jew will become the Antichrist, as the apocalypse said in the New Testament.
Muin Rabbani,
going to see World War III out of this, maybe. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Muin Rabbani. The panic and fear that Harold describes in Israel's choice of Syria as a target. Do you see Israel panicking?
Well, I think basically Israel has reached a dead end because the current government in Israel has basically taken a decision that its current confrontation with the Palestinians will only be resolved as the result of an Israeli military victory, and therefore it has consistently sought to undermine any political initiatives that have been undertaken, and it's already declared victory X times and been wrong each time. And so now I think its attack on Syria is, in a sense, an act of desperation through having yet again failed to quell the Palestinian uprising through military means. As the caller indicated, there is, apart from a large-scale invasion of the Gaza Strip, there's really very little that it hasn't tried in terms of military action within the occupied territories. So it's now engaging in this kind of, you know, well, let's see who else we can lash out at to end our problems. This reminds me, in a way, of the U.S. attack on Iraq, which we were also told would send a very clear message to the Palestinian organizations in the occupied territories and ensure quiet and send messages to all and sundry. That didn't happen. I don't see why this would work.
Matthew Levitt, the suicide bomb attack in Haifa killed 19 people on the weekend of Yom Kippur. Did that change something in the mind of the Israeli cabinet because of the number of people killed there or the timing? Or does Israel have a very, very calculated program of how to respond at whatever level it's provoked?
There is no calculus to this type of action. This is an art, if you will, not a science. I do think that the various symbols that were attacked in this recent attack led the Israelis to take an option that has been on the shelf for some while and implement it. It's not just it's a sense that the terrorist groups believe they can act with impunity anytime, anywhere, knowing that they will not be responded to with all the power at Israel's disposal because Israel doesn't want to target civilians, and therefore it's not just carpet bombing, places that these individuals come from in the West Bank or where they're trained or are funded from in Syria and elsewhere. It's not just that this was on the weekend of Yom Kippur, the holiest date in the Jewish calendar. It's also that it targeted a restaurant that was owned by Arabs, a place that was a symbol of Jewish-Arab coexistence. It claimed in this attack several children. At every level, it was a very, very painful attack. But it's only one of many, many in a very long string of attacks. I think Israel looks at the United States, for example, and sees that when Iraq sent a terrorist squad to assassinate President Bush Sr., the United States lobbed missiles at Iraqi command and control centers. When al-Qaeda bombed our embassies in East Africa, we bombed a terrorist training camp and camps in Afghanistan and a site we believed at the time was linked to al-Qaeda in Sudan. And here Israel is choosing to act in a similar fashion against a target that is a known terrorist target and it knew would claim very few, if any, lives. It sends a very important message that if the terrorists believe that they can operate with impunity anytime, anywhere, they should understand that there's a consequence for that.
But the other important message, Matthew, is that Israel is saying this is now and solely now a war on terror. It doesn't have anything to do with the options for negotiating for land or...
What do you see? I really disagree. I think that what Israel says, and, you know, the politics of this particular administration as they are, I think it's still very clear that Israelis across the board want to resume a negotiated, peaceful political option. But they don't feel they can do that when there are suicide bombers going off left and right. And the Israeli public has demonstrated time and again that when it feels that there is a real prospect for a negotiated solution, it will vote in a Labor or otherwise liberal government time and again. And to the same extent, every time it feels that there is no such hope and that its enemies are acting against it with impunity, it votes in a right-wing government. I think that if the Palestinians and if Israel's Arab neighbors were to create a space in which there was a time of freedom from these attacks, very quickly they'd find that the Israeli population is still amenable to that and would vote in a government that would be far more amenable to the type of peaceful negotiated solution that Muin is talking about.
Let's hear from Muin on this, whether or not Israel is demonstrating any of that kind of openness or leaving any options open for the political conversation that Matthew's describing.
Well, of course, it's perfectly understandable that no state will want to negotiate while seaside restaurants are being blown up by suicide bombers, or for that matter, refugee camps are being attacked in Jenin and neighborhoods and then leveled. But the fact of the matter is, if we were to set a criteria that peace will only begin to be negotiated once the violence ends, the U.S. would still be in Vietnam. The French would still be in Algeria. The British would still be in all of Ireland. I mean, one negotiates precisely because there's violence and conflict. That's precisely why one seeks to seek a negotiated settlement. So when I, hear this constant refrain that negotiations won't begin until after the conflict ends, well, what are you going to negotiate about? It sounds very much like an excuse precisely to avoid a negotiated settlement rather than to foster one.
But how do you know, Muin, that that's not happening now? None of us knew what was going on in Oslo. None of us knew that, this set or that set of secret negotiations were going on.
Well, of course, I can't state with absolute certainty that there's no negotiations going on a permanent settlement, although there's absolutely no indication that they are. And just, in the very recent history, we did have, the roadmap announced, and Islamic Jihad and Hamas, despite their very serious misgivings and opposition, in fact, to that initiative, due to a number of circumstances, did agree to a unilateral ceasefire. And then because that was not reciprocated by Israel, it only lasted a few weeks till it was blown out of the water. So, you can't on the one hand claim that you want to have negotiations in the absence of violence, and at the same time, when you're given that opportunity, treat it as if it's meaningless.
All right, let's take a call from Toronto now. Stephen's joining us on the line. Hi, Stephen.
How are you doing?
Fine, thanks for waiting.
This is a subject that troubles me deeply for both as somebody who's used to study political science and also as somebody who's got a friend who's a pediatric urological surgeon in Jerusalem. And this poor guy has aged 10 years since the end of the Intifada started, because what he's doing is sewn up little babies and children who have been ripped to shreds. Instead of fixing birth defects, he's trying to put people back together that have been torn apart by rusty nails and ball bearings and shrapnel targeted directly at, civilian
and
populations.
Who, other than the people who are building those bombs, Stephen, who's letting your friend down?
Well, I've been a critic from time to time of Israel, and I wanted them to make some initiatives towards peace. But one of the things that I found very disturbing is that when there was a chance for a stop under Barak, as far as I could see, Arafat walked away from the table.
He did
that with Hezbollah and Syria, pushing them on, saying, "We drove them out of Lebanon." They didn't drive them out. The Israelis pulled out, but they treated that as a victory.
Bring us to right now, Stephen.
I'm sorry?
I want you to talk to me about right now, whether or not you think that the United States can do more than it's doing, whether or not you think this is something where Israel has to take the action that it's taking right now.
I think it has to. And I think the disturbing problem is this. We're in a situation where surrogacy is rampant. If Hamas decides that they're going to go along with the truce, Hezbollah or Islamic Jihad or somebody being shipped in from somewhere else will make sure that it doesn't happen, because the neighbors around there don't want it. Most of these are repressive regimes. They like it fine that they have a bête noire that can be blamed for everything and not have to take and modernize and not have to face their own people and not have to take and educate their populations. I mean, the world around these people oppress their own populations in the name of fighting Israel, and a small subsidization of bloodthirsty religious zealots or political zealots who are desperate, is only guaranteed to make sure this keeps going on. And somebody has to stop it somehow. And somebody has to make it clear that this is not the way to go.
And Matthew Levitt, that somebody keeps being referred to as someone somehow from Washington, that regardless of what is happening now, that regardless of whatever military action Israel chooses to take in response to suicide bombing, that somebody from Washington needs to go, someone with standing needs to go back, and in the president's words, ride herd. And that doesn't seem to be happening. Is that your view or not?
I think the administration has tried to do just that several times and has been frustrated by the fact that every time they have failed because of a surge again in Palestinian violence. I think that's what has caused the administration to come out so vocally and strongly against Palestinian violence and fingered that as the greatest impediment to peace. Mm-hmm. I think one of the great recent example is this myth of a ceasefire. In fact, Hamas and Islamic Jihad and others did agree to a ceasefire, and they did not conduct suicide bombing attacks. But at the very same time, the Israelis and Americans were noticing that they were rebuilding, refunding, rearming, so that they could do something in a week, in a month, in 3 months. And that is not sufficient. We need to remove the capacity for groups who are bent on destroying Israel, not just undermining the peace process, from being able to do that. Otherwise, I talk to Palestinian Authority officials all the time, and they say to me, Hamas and Islamic Jihad are out to undermine us even more than they are Israel.
And Muin Rabbani, the U.S. acceptance of the strike in Syria, how does that change Washington's range of options to, in some way, re-enter the region as a broker, as someone who would try and breathe new life into a peace process?
Well, I think the obvious effect will be that those very few people who are still in the Arab world, who are prepared to see the U.S. as a so-called honest broker, will be disabused of that illusion. But I think more generally, the real danger now is that if Syria and the United States are unable to work out a compromise for a U.N. Security Council resolution in response to this Israeli attack on Syria, and if Syria feels that it has to respond in one way or another to show that it simply can't be bullied and intimidated by Israel, then I think we begin to enter the possibility that Syria will seek perhaps a military response through Lebanon, although indications are that may well have happened already last night. And then I think we really began to get into a much more dangerous situation of consistent retaliation and counter-retaliation and escalation. And that can have very disastrous consequences.
All right. Muin, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Muin Rabbani, a senior Middle East analyst for the International Crisis Group in Amman, Jordan. Matthew Levitt, thanks for your time.
Dick, a pleasure as always.
Matthew is senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Earlier in the hour, we talked with Barbara Plett, BBC correspondent, currently based in Ramallah. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.